Doug. We got you. Bryce, are you online?
Hey, good afternoon. Yes. Yes, Bryce is here.
Okay. Can I find out who else is dialed in, please?
Jennifer Johnson from Oregon State Treasury.
Thank you. Is there anybody else dialed in? I have Bryce Stagg, Doug Middlesetter, and Jennifer Johnson. Okay.
Hello, everyone. This is the annual meeting of the Municipal Debt Advisory Committee. You all are here and you know what that means. I'll turn it over to Nancy, who is the chair of the committee.
Commission.
Thank you. I think this is, feels really echoey. I'm going to start by saying sign-up sheets on both sides of the room. If you have not already signed up, please do so. If you sign up, leave your email. You'll get the meeting packet materials. If you don't, then you don't, and you're lost. So I call the meeting of the Municipal Debt Advisory Committee to order. I'll note members Bryce Static and Doug Middlesetter are on the phone. I believe everybody else on the committee is present, or commission is present. So we're going to start with a presentation on impacts of federal tax reform on the municipal market. It's Trish. Thank you. Thank you. There's a little switch in the middle of the top.
Are we on now?
That's it.
Okay, great. So first I want to just note that we do have a very short period of time today, so I cut down my presentation as much as possible to just hit on the main points that affect the municipal market. So as a brief recap, the timeline was really, really quick for the tax reform from being in discussion to being adopted. And so what we found in November, early November, the House version of the bill, which is formerly known as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, kind of like print, the bill eliminated advance refunding. It eliminated private activity bonds, which are all 501c3 bonds, and certain court bonds and other types of bonds classified as private activity bonds. And then it also eliminated tax credit bonds and bonds to finance professional sports stadiums. Senate bill was released about a week later, which retained certain of those items. It retained the private activity bonds and retained professional sports stadiums, but still eliminated advance refunding and tax credit bonds. In December, a conference bill was released, which took pieces from each of the bills and came out with a bill that was consistent with the Senate provision with respect to municipal bonds. And so ultimately, the bill that was signed by the President December 22 eliminated advance refunding and eliminated tax credit bonds. So what does that mean? So the direct effect on the municipal marketplace is that any bond issued to advance refund bonds after December 31, 2017 cannot be issued on a tax-exempt basis. And those are bonds that are issued more than 90 days prior to the date of redemption of the bonds being refunded. The bill also eliminated tax credit bonds that were issued after that date. That's, you know, a few names here, but I don't know how much those were out in the market in Oregon, but those are clean energy bonds and energy-related bonds for the most part. Then another important point is that there were no transition rules, which means that the bill didn't say anything with respect to if you were advanced refunding. If you started the advance refunding in December, could you continue the advance refunding in 2018? If you had a bond that was a debt that was issued in 2018, like upon anticipation note or something like that, could you advance or fund those? There was no transition rule explaining how that would work. And then the important point is that there was no repeal of the private activity bond. But because that was pending and threatened up through December 22nd when the bill was finally signed, there was a flood of late 2017 transactions, both including the advance of funding and including private activity bonds. There are indirect effects on the municipal marketplace as well. Those indirect effects, a lot of them are yet to be seen. We can't really tell what is going on in the marketplace because of the sheer amount of volatility. So it's hard to see the actual concrete effect. But some people theorize that the reduction in the corporate tax rate, because it reduced corporate tax rate to 21%, that can possibly reduce the value of tax exemption on municipal bonds, and therefore reduce the desire for investors to go out and buy taxable bonds. It also could trigger interest rate adjustments on outstanding private placements. Some people are seeing that now in the debt that they have with a private banker. There was a provision that said if the corporate tax rate goes down, we get to raise your rate. There was also a repeal of the corporate alternative minimum tax, which may increase the value of AMT bonds, which were a certain subcategory of tax-exempt bonds that still had different treatment for the alternative minimum tax. There's also an increase in tax rates on insurance companies with tax-exempt interest, again, possibly reducing the desire for the marketplace to buy tax-exempt bonds. There's also a tax on large private university endowments, which as far as large widespread effect, it's hard to see, but it could affect university borrowers and their bottom line. Finally, the $10,000 limitation on deduction of state local taxes could make an increase in the after cost tax the after tax cost to taxpayers of state and local taxes. We see that in Oregon. See that in other states, mostly the states like California and East Coast, New York, states with high levels and state taxes. And then, therefore, it might, some theorize, increase the value of the state or local tax exemption for municipal bonds that are sold with a, Oregon bond may be exempt from the state of Oregon state taxes. So there's some weird things that might be done to help in the advance for funding world. For the most part, Carol and Nikolai are going to talk a little bit about some alternatives and some things that can be done on the private placement side. So I'll just kind of leave this for you. The materials will be available when you take a look. So some other issues with respect to advance for funding are a question of whether you can advance for fund taxable bonds and other taxable debt on a tax-exempt basis. And in some cases, taxable debt can be issued, which can then be refunded on a tax-exempt basis because the purpose of the bond is eligible for tax-exempt for funding. However, it's unclear whether in this world you can advance for fund the taxable bond on a tax-exempt basis. And so there's a lot of bond counselors discussing this issue with the IRS and was looking for guidance because we just don't know the answer yet. That would be if you took out a line of credit or some other taxable loan that had a longer call period and wanted to take it out with tax-exempt debt. It might not be able to be done on a tax-exempt basis without further guidance. I'll just give this guy this slide because we don't have a lot of time, but it's about the state and local tax exemption and some distinctions between that and the federal exemption. So what's the future hold? Right now, we've seen so far in the 18th to get lower volume, which both is as a result of the flood of volume in December and November of 2017, and also because of the volatility in the marketplace. But that lower volume also makes it hard for us to really gauge what the real tangible effect is on the marketplace for municipal bonds. We need to see what the IRS guidelines going to be with respect to certain of those types of advances funding, the taxable debt. We also need to see if the IRS or the market is going to, the IRS or the regulators are going to come out with guidelines for transition rules. We also need to know if there's going to become a developed market for state and local tax exempt bonds, where they're exempt from state taxes and local taxes, but federally taxable. And so far, we haven't seen a market open up, but it was something that we hear about. So, any questions? I'm told we had short period of time, so I wanted to make sure I had to highlight. All right, well, then I guess I can go ahead and hand it over to Carol. Do you need the microphone?
No.
I'm really loud. I assume all of you can hear me. Yeah.
We got to record as an official meeting here. Okay. You're all official.
Okay. Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. I was given 5 minutes to talk about advanced refunding alternatives, and I can do it in less. Because. First of all, there was a session on this yesterday, a really good session, that Duncan went over the various alternatives, and I imagine your presentation is posted on the website. So those of you who are unable to attend, I encourage you to look at that. And so I would sum up the alternatives to advanced refunding as follows. None of them are any good. Advanced refundings were better. The best option, in my opinion, is to work on legislation to repeal the repeal. And I know, Laura, you're going to be talking about this. Personally, one of the options that Duncan did not talk about is the one Trish touched on that I happen to think has some possibility. Is the notion of foregoing the tax exemption at all at the beginning, issuing taxable bonds, which releases you from all of the other tax exemption rules and limitations, and then hopefully preserving your ability to refinance it potentially on an advanced basis on a tax exempt basis in the future. Obviously, that only works if the taxable market and the tax-exempt market are fairly close together in terms of cost. But I like that idea. One of the other things that concerns me about the elimination of the ability to advance refunds is not just giving up savings, which to me, in an environment where we supposedly care about infrastructure, makes no sense. But something else that jurisdictions use advanced refunding for all the time is restructuring, and it's troubling to me that that option is now being much more constrained. I think I met my 5 minutes.
You did good.
Okay.
Disclosures, those are in the hard copies of the board. So very quickly,
some history visuals. Banks have become increasingly large holders of municipal bonds, particularly since the financial crisis. A couple of reasons for that. One is the appetite for tax exempt income among banks, the ones that are profitable. The notion of being able to replace fee income with tax exempt income. But most importantly, over the last 10 years of the financial crisis, is the political and regulatory pressure from Washington, particularly the last administration, to increase lending to prompt recovery. So that the holdings are up to about 15% of the total holdings in the municipal market. Now, Carol and Chris did a great job summarizing the impact of tax reform. I think one of the most important ones, and most important one going forward, is just the different impact between different types of investors. In particular, among corporate entities, and that includes banks, the marginal tax rate went from 35 to 21%. So when we talk about what is the advantage of tax-exempt income, that advantage has gone down appreciably for banks. Not so much for individuals, not so much for all of us here in the room. For a family, a married couple with $100,000 of income, that rate will only drop 3%, and that's going to be a temporary cut at that. So a big difference between individual investors and corporate entities, and that's going to play out in some of the interest rate comparisons we'll show you in just a moment here. In variable rate debt, typically variable rate debt is reset every week for weekly reset bonds, daily for daily reset, monthly for monthly reset bonds. The way we have mimicked that in bank variable rate documents is by setting up an index. Sometimes the documents will use a SIFMA index, and that's a tax-exempt index, and that doesn't create any issues. Most banks, however, fund their loans in the LIBOR market, and that's the most efficient way to get bank funding. So most bank documents will have a LIBOR rate, and will mimic the tax exemption on that by setting that rate at 7% of 1 month LIBOR, and 67% 1 month LIBOR. Now, in a reset and variable rate demand bond, those investors can reflect their changes in taxability each week. We mimic that in a bank document with a provision called margin rate factor, so that as the tax rate changes, the index changes for those loans. The advantage of that is that somebody who entered into a direct purchase, a variable rate direct purchase, a year ago, when President Trump was talking about 15% corporate tax rate, didn't have to have that price as if there was only a 15% corporate tax benefit. So it was all based on the index. Now, of course, what has happened then is, as of January 2nd, first day of the new year, that mechanism triggered a gross up. So for most variable rate borrowers, their rate increased if they had a LIBOR-based rate, approximately 1.22% in a typical scenario. Each document was potentially different, and different banks approached it differently. But so that's been what a lot of variable rate borrowers have been dealing with if they had a tax-exempt rate based on a corporate index. Now, what's been really interesting since tax reform is the differences in rates and the vast fluctuations in rates. So in the run-up at the end of December to the implementation of the tax reform, this month spiked dramatically. And as one might expect, that the buyer of the paper would be asking for a higher return to reflect the lower tax-exempt benefit. What then happened in January was a dramatic drop in SIFMA relative to LIBOR, and then again, more recently, it's been spiking up again. The market is clearly still trying to find its sea legs. in these relationships, and there's some important dynamics behind this. One of those is that bond investors are parking money on the short end of the yield curve. Many large institutional investors have large business staffs, BlackRock of the world, are monetizing profits on the long end of the yield curve. So there's money being parked. Even more interesting is to me just the unintended consequences of tax reform. So part of the idea of tax reform was to repatriate profits, like the capital profits that are being held overseas. As that is happening, and in anticipation of further profits coming back to the United States, banks internationally are now having to build up their liquidity and are issuing commercial paper to do so, and that's driving LIBOR up, and that's causing these fluctuations between the system on LIBOR index. So it remains to be seen where this relationship ends up. I think our desk and a number of desks on the street expect that as tax season progresses, in light of the funding costs for dealers and as some of these supply issues settle out, that relationship should be at more like 75% to 80% of one-month LIBOR. Currently, it's 66% of one-month LIBOR, just shy of 66% of one-month LIBOR. In the meantime, people who have variable rate debt are looking at alternatives. One of the key advantages of variable rate debt, and one of the reasons why it's being discussed as one of the alternatives as well for the future, is that variable rate debt is very flexible in terms of calling. So people who have variable rate debt can choose to go into a different mode, potentially with the same bank provider, potentially in the public market, and some are actually looking at the possibility of just fixing out their debt, given the differences in rates. It's still unclear which one will prevail, but what's interesting is that the public market, either index bonds, sometimes referred to as floating rate notes, that market, because of the buyers behind it, mostly funds, but a limited buyer base, that is still being written at 7% of one-month LIBOR, and it's quite strong right now. It's a fickle market. There are other times where it simply dries up because of the relationship with other investment options. But right now, that is a desirable alternative. Variable rate bonds with LOCs or liquidity facilities, the old way all these variable rate bonds were done, looks more attractive now because of those buyers have strong demand. We are not yet seeing, one might have expected, that foreign banks who weren't participating in the direct purchase market because they didn't have the same tax advantages might be stepping up. And there are secular reasons for why Japanese banks and Chinese banks and other banks are not yet doing so. So to the extent that letters of credit and liquidity facilities are being written, it's still primarily the U.S. Market. The other way that that direct purchases are used, and so if you work for a bank, you think of it as direct purchase from an issuer's perspective of a bank placement, is for fixed rate bonds. And so we've seen a lot of this in the last few years, where particularly for bonds from 1 to 10 years out, it can be a very efficient way of refunding bonds instead of going to the public market. There's no need to go to the rating agency. There's no need for an official statement. But that's wholly dependent on the relationship between the LIBOR curve and the MMT curve. So, for example, in early 2007, Laura, your former employer, did $100 million as a 10-year bank placement because it was cheaper than doing a public market sale, but that will wholly depend on the relationship between the various yield curves. There is still demand for this among banks. It's been much slower in this year, and obviously the pricing changed. but that continues to be an option. So for the future, I think the most important thing on this page to leave you with is that the market continues to try to find its sea legs. It's unusual to see so much volatility in such a short time frame between SIFMA and LIBOR, and we'll, I think most issuers are taking a wait-and-see perspective to find out before they make changes which will be the ultimate choice. I want to stay over 5 minutes. Any questions?
Nick, from Jeff Oster from Texas. You mentioned not having sort of reading. One of the things I thought that Adam, Christina, and Carl, you disagree with both, and you say that at the end of the issue. You don't have to buy law, but if there is existing debt, this is debt. And so you view it as an effective rating, and you want to make sure that all investors know that these transactions are occurring.
Thank you. Let me clarify the language. So the facility that is purchased, the direct purchase, doesn't require a rating from the banks who are purchasing it. The entire marketplace has taken the perspective that you need to share your documents, whether it's on posting on MO, sharing with those who raise your parity debt, that information. But the purchaser is the requirement. Thank you for that clarification.
Go ahead. And thank you, Nikolai. And Jeff, just one further point on that. Like you were saying, Nikolai, about the absence of certain requirements in connection with direct placement, really sort of this group really understands this, but another element of it is continuing disclosure. While it is currently not a requirement for making EMMA filings with respect to direct placements, that may or may not be the case on a going forward basis, depending on what the MSRB does with Rule 15C212. So, again, letting your investors know about your existing debt portfolio as a whole is a good best practice to be followed as you enter into debt transactions.
If I could add, MDAC has taken the stand that we want all bank loans private placements in our database so that we can move over that from debt reports. Communities can be comfortable that all the debt is outstanding. You know, of course, we're not concerned about conduits, but anything where it affects the debt.
Any other questions? And I'm going to ask Bryce or Doug, did you have any questions or need any information?
No, there's no questions from Bryce.
This is Doug. No questions right now. Thank you.
Thank you. So next up we have Laura Lockwood McCall on legislation.
Now, some of you probably were following us. We were following fairly closely the Treasurer's office. We didn't talk about two or three bills that I think directly impact the bond market in Oregon. Probably the number one is HJR 201, which is approved by the legislature, and I think it's on the governor's desk. And that would be a carve-out in our state constitution that would allow local governments and other cities, counties, special districts to sell general obligation bonds for affordable housing. The state currently has a GO bond program for affordable housing. We're using an existing carve-out, and it means that we have to either own or operate affordable housing, which is a bit complicated, but we've made it work. But the Constitution forbids really general obligation bonds for private purposes, benefiting private parties. So this is aimed specifically to a lot of the same kind of gap financing that the state's been doing through what's called the LIFT program. And that's been pretty successful, and we plan to sell a lot more bonds. These are all sold on a taxable basis to avoid any complications under tax law. So we may have more opportunities. I think somebody mentioned taxable bonds with a state exemption. We plan to grow that market in our state in the next year or two. As we're going through the legislative process and different stakeholders were participating, I know Metro has been talking in the Portland area about doing fairly significant with lots of zeros, I think 9 zeros. So they were actively participating. Rather than try to define affordable housing, because it can mean different things in different parts of the state, the bond election would have to describe what it means in the context of their particular transaction. So I think that solved one set of problems. So it could be duplexes in Sherwood, and it could be multi-story, you know, affordable housing in Portland, just to give you a contrast. They also added a provision requiring a bond proceeds spending oversight committee, which I think will be useful and helpful as people make that decision this fall. If there's any questions, you can find on the legislature's website. Then the second one is kind of a two-parter, and it's not so much that we're going to see more bonds for, but I think everybody's worried about PERS and credit quality and what the future holds, particularly as we go into the 1921 budget cycle. Someone mentioned the corporate repatriation, but our state legislature chose to do with that money. We see about $140 million net. It's actually $160 million, but then there's a $20 million small business tax credit program. They took $140 million in Senate Bill 1529, and they deposited it in Senate Bill 1566 into two accounts that are side accounts to PERS. One, the larger of the two is for school districts. $115 million is going to be in a pooled side account and allocated in a fashion across all the school districts based on payroll, I assume, some kind of pro rata formula. And this will help offset. And I think there may be other PERS reserves that are freed up that could be then added to that side pool side account, which will help offset rate increases that are anticipated in the 1921 budget cycle. $25 million is placed into a separate fund, and I'm sorry I don't have the acronym, but basically it's a separate pot of money that's an incentive fund, and it's available to cities, to counties, to universities, in the public realm, school districts. And it is a match pot. And the idea is that the state will match 25 cents to your dollar if you want to put money in prepay in your side account. But the one caveat is that you can't use borrowed money. This was an idea that was first promoted by OHSU, who has fairly significant cash reserves. They need to have a certain amount of working capital. But it's really idle capital that sits in the state's short-term fund and it earns kind of a relatively low rate of return because it's in the short-term fund. So this is an idea that they could park a certain percentage of their cash in the side account, help offset their rates. It's open to anyone who has, you know, PERS liability. And I don't know if everybody will want to give up their fund balance in cash to get 25 cents extra to stick in a side account. But the first group of applicants will be allowed, I think it's in 6 months from, I think it starts on July 1st. If they have PERS UAL liability, that's 200% of payroll or more. And I haven't done the math as to what that really means, Carol. Maybe you know what that means more than me. And then if the $25 million is still there, which is leveraging $100 million of cash for different communities, then it's open to everybody else after the first 180 days. Do you have a sense as to whether...
It varies by jurisdiction.
Yeah. The minimum... match is 25 grand, and then the maximum is the greater of $300,000 or 5% of your UAL. And again, I don't have a sense of scale of whether one community could just eat up the whole pot. So that's going to go, and I don't know if that's been signed in by the governor, but I anticipate that it will be. Those are my highlights. I don't know if anything else came in the bond world. Just kind of quick and dirty short session. That's it for state.
Okay. Any questions on? Any questions?
Any questions on state?
On federal?
Sure. And I'll be very brief. In your package, the moment that Emily sent me from the GFOA Federal Liaison Center that a bill had been introduced to restore advance rate funding, is HAR 5003. Immediately whipped into action and sent emails, of course, during the legislative session, so nobody paid attention in the front office, the treasurer's office, but was asked that the commission decide whether we would be interested in trying to get our federal delegation to co-sponsor this legislation. Basically, this restores advance rate funding. I would note that in the infrastructure package that was released by the Trump administration, they were restoring it for private activity bonds. So I just think that in the rush to get federal tax reform done, no one stopped and thought. Now, I have no idea if HR 5003 has a clue of a chance, but we've got to start somewhere. And so I would really turn it to you, Nancy, in terms of what we've done before, in terms of the board vote, and getting a letter to our federal delegation, and I'm going to try and continue to get the treasurer to also promote this. He's getting more involved in the National Association of State Treasurers, who I think has gone on record in favor of this as well.
So I'll look to board members. Do you think that we ought to support this and write a letter on behalf of the commission? I'm getting nods. Bryce and Doug, do you concur?
Yes,
I do.
All right.
I concur as well.
Okay, well, Treasury will work with you as our chair to get that going in the next week or two.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I'm not sure we're going to get traction either, but it doesn't hurt to try. And it lets us later say we told you so. The next item we have on the agenda is another piece of potential legislation for MDAC to propose in the 2019 session. In the packet, there's a brief kind of problem statement. This came up as a bond deal was being put together for a community college that crosses county lines, and different county assessors were giving different ratios of real market value, some of them including veterans exemptions as real market value, and some of them excluding veterans exemptions from real market value. There was some back and forth with the state at the time, and there's some information in the packet about how this is accounted. The veterans exemption is not gigantic by any remote stretch anywhere, but it does cause some heartburn when numbers don't match, and when in particular, maybe what was published in CAPR is just a little bit different than what goes out in those bond funding documents. And in terms of ongoing disclosure, I think it can leave us wondering exactly what number we're supposed to report to make sure that we're being consistent. So I came up with a couple of ideas for bills. One is basically to clarify that taxable value is what's presented in the SAL that each county presents each year. It basically ignores the veterans exemption altogether, would be a consistent number. Another one would be to require county assessors to include the veterans exemption on the SAL. So again, heading for consistency. I'm open to any other ideas, and I'm open to anybody suggesting if there's one of these we want to support to get drafted as a legislative concept.
So the generally Treasury carries bills and tries to work bills for MDAC, but we don't like controversy. We like technical improvements. And so my question would be, will there be assessors who are on both sides of this? So are we stepping into something that we don't need today, or do you think that we can go with your approach and every assessor is going to be okay with it?
Well,
I'm looking at the people who sell bonds all
the time. My assumption would be asking assessors to put the veterans exemption on the SAO would be more work and less likely to get traction, whereas clarifying that for purpose of a bond sale, the taxable value is the measure 5 real market value as presented on the SAO would mean assessors don't have to do anything different.
Okay, that's a good answer.
That's my take. It does not create more work for what I think most of us would agree are often overworked and underfunded assessor's offices across the state. So
okay. Well, if we write it in a way we can do it, if a bond attorney or two could help draft the legislative concept so we get the language that you're suggesting, then I don't think there's a problem.
And that would have you help anyway, Laura. I would also suggest as we're doing that, working closely with the Legislative Council's office to get a narrow relating clause so that it can, again, maintain fairly low-key, non-controversial bill, something that folks hopefully can't glom onto for other purposes.
So for people on the phone, this is Carol Samuels. This came up with a client that we were working on with Jim Shannon and Courtney Dodd, and it was just confusing as to how to measure a legal debt capacity, which almost no jurisdiction comes anywhere near. So it's more an academic test than a real limit.
But my sense is that assessors would prefer to have what we call the measure of real market value, because the veterans exemptions go up and down every year and have to be tracked. So my only question, Chris, is if you have a narrow related clause, are we eliminating options for other technical correct? I don't know if MDAC is going to run a broader bill or...
That's a good question. I mean, we don't have any power over it. That'll come from the Legislative Council's office, and it's just something I think that MDAC would want to track. But to Laura's point, you know, the MDAC bills usually have a fairly narrow relating clause so that they are non-controversial, and since it's a property tax-related thing, it would have the potential to be a vehicle for other folks to climb onto our train and use it for their own purposes, which... I don't think we would.
Okay, so I'm going to ask whether or not, Bryce, do you have any comments on the issue?
No, do we have a sense of the overall size throughout the state of the exemption in total? I mean,
from the Department of Revenue was that in Lane County in 2016-17, the veterans exemption was 0.00449% of the total RMV. So it's not enough that it's going to swing anything, and it's not a big enough issue that you're going to be, oh my word, I'm up against my debt capacity. It's just more trying to make sure that we're consistent and that, and in particular, from county to county, it's being treated the same.
Got it. Then I would tend to agree with your thoughts, Nancy, that the principle of parsimony, just being able to administer it efficiently, makes a lot of sense.
Okay. Thank you. Paul? I'm sorry, Doug?
Yes, I agree. The statement of keeping it simple and less obtrusive and easy to apply, and again, a small matter, a small amount that's having an effect on anything. So I would concur as well.
All right, thank you. And I don't have any comments. Lori, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I just wonder if there's value in running this by the assessor's organization and letting them know kind of what we're looking to do, give them a heads up.
That's a good point. Thank you. And Paul, did you want to add
anything? No, I'm good. Right. Let's clean this up.
Okay.
If I could add, I have to turn in legislative concepts in April, so I'm going to need at least a green light from the commission to start. And then we can try and hook up as we get a concept to the assessors.
Okay.
But as I was listening to you, I was wondering if it might also make sense to keep it non-controversial if your various associations that are represented here, at some point, association counties, league cities, school boards, we should also distribute it to them. And if everybody kind of agrees this is good, if, you know, it will stay non-controversial and less likely will be amended and expanded. We're losing our great representative who helped us oversee the rewriting of all the state public finance laws, Phil Barnhart, retiring. And so we'll have a new revenue chair to cope with. So having the weigh-in from all these different parties would be probably a good thing for us to consider doing for this new individual.
All right. So I'm going to make sure I'm doing this right. So I'm going to entertain a motion that we ask Treasury to get a legislative concept or draft that clarifies the taxable value of the Measure 5 RMV as presented in the SAL, that will be information we will share with our respective statewide organizations to work to seek their support for that concept. Does that?
And if I can make a friendly amendment, that at least one member of our commission who's an attorney will assist us in pinpoint language that accomplishes.
Thank you.
I can move that with the amendment.
All right, so it's been moved by Lori Steele.
Second.
Seconded by Paul Matthews. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. Appreciate that. And so next I'm going to turn it over to Chris Reynolds for an update from California.
Thank you, Nancy. So in your packet, you have the Senate Bill 450 from California. this is now codified in the California government code, and it requires the disclosure of certain financial information before the authorization and issuance of bonds. This measure was introduced by the equivalent of MDAC in California, CDAC, and the state treasurer's office, and it came out of certain fraud issues associated with a single issuer in California, and as a result of these issues, it heightens the scrutiny by the state treasurer's office and CDAC concerning disclosures about bond finance transactions before they're authorized, with a goal of, or a purported goal of, furthering the public information and interest. The implementation of this, however, has been pretty challenging because there's not a lot of guidance about how to do it, and it also requires a lot of estimates being done with respect to bond finance transactions before you price the transaction or really completed the deal. The time for these good faith estimates to be made is prior to the authorization for issuance, so there's a lot of different ways that local governments are trying to implement this. Some of them are including it as exhibits to their resolutions, and others of them are merely including it in staff reports. Overall, this idea is sort of capturing a truth in lending concept from home mortgages and trying to get information out there about your lending, the borrowing that a governmental entity is undertaking. The good faith estimates that are included in it are really things that I think most Oregon issuers are already including in their resolutions largely anyhow. They include a principal amount, a statement clearly about the principal amount that you're expecting to issue, a statement of the true interest cost based on the market rate prevailing at the time, the finance charges expected for the financing, and that is your cost of issuance. So all of your costs for everything from printing the official statement to paying your bond counsel, paying your municipal advisor, your underwriter, your rating agencies, all in what you're expecting to pay for your cost of issuance as an estimate before you started the transaction. An estimate of the amount of proceeds you expect to be received, again, before you price. An estimate of the total debt service schedule and payment amount, all, again, before you've done anything. So you'll be working early and earlier in the transaction with your municipal advisor and your underwriter if you're doing a negotiated sale to put together this package of material to present to your governing body. And this is what issuers in California are doing. And it is out there. It is California state law. Folks are following it and doing the best they can to implement it. I, as Oregon-based practitioner, think that MDAC already has a great process for getting a lot of that information out to the public at the time where it's actually meaningful, which is as part of what you're filing with your MDAC report, because you're already providing a lot of that information when you have real information. And also, I think a lot of issuers are already including much of that in estimates in their parameters in their authorizing resolutions. I know we always recommend including a lot of that information in the authorizing resolutions when we're working with clients, so that the authorized representative, the finance director, has clear delegated authority within appropriate parameters to take action with the client. As my report, I would be happy to answer questions.
There is
a month.
Come join. Join the party. It's a clean bond opinion.
Sorry. The penalty, it has nothing to do with the bond opinion. And in fact, if you fail to comply, it does not, it says specifically that it does not impact the validity of the bond.
Yeah.
But it is compliance on the local government side, and they do want to make sure that they're complying. The problem is what they use in the past is parameters, as Chris said, which are maximum. Whereas now they're asking for a good faith estimate, which, especially given the market right now being so volatile, it's difficult to figure out what that could possibly mean.
My only comment is, if I had to get my legislative body to approve things before we did it, we would never sell anything. So on a practical basis, I can't see it being applicable for state agencies. And thinking about university financing, everything is delegated, as Chris mentioned, to finance officers. And everything is recorded, all of this information is recorded in NDOC and it's public information. So I don't know that, I hope we think we have a good process and enough transparency that we don't need to go this extra mile. If, you know, if somebody wants to commit fraud, I don't know that this is going to stop them. So.
I think there is a few other politics and personalities involved in the introduction and implementation of this legislation. So we are good to go here.
Turn that off on you.
It's okay. So the other business. This is my last official meeting. I'm termed out at June 30th. I think I'll be writing a letter between now and then. And I want to note that Doug Middlestetter's also last meeting. He's also termed out. So Doug is an Oregon School Boards Association appointee, or I guess recommended nominee. The governor appoints. I'm a League of Oregon Cities nominee. So I heartily encourage you, and I would say throughout that I've been kind of hitting up people who are interested. We need to get some names in front of OSBA and in front of LLC to replace these two positions. I will say this is the hardest job I have ever done.
Let me just give you a piece of time here.
This is a good job. It's a good opportunity for some professional development. It is not uber time consuming. Really good staff. Laura's really helpful. Martha's really helpful. So I'm not putting the agendas together. I'm not doing any of the rest of that. So I heartily encourage you to apply. If you are not a city representative or a school board representative, but you know someone who you think would be good, it's an opportunity to put a bug in their ear and make sure that they get their interest known for this really professional development opportunity. It's a great thing to put on your resume.
If I could add, we also need one of our commission members to serve as chair. So if someone here on the phone or sitting at the table wants to be the next chair, we also often make recommendations to the governor's office about that.
Okay. Is there any other business to come before the MDAC? And if not, we're going to call the meeting closed. Thank you all for coming.
Bye, Bryce. Bye, Doug.
Goodbye. Good afternoon.
I did not even have a...
Your conference is ending now. As requested by the host, please hang.